Hello, everyone. Welcome to the 108th episode of the Manor Podcast. I'm your co-host, Roger Bodie, joined as always with my best friend and other co-host, Michael Hamilton. Michael, what's your, like, healthy snack you've been snacking on lately? Do you have any healthy snacks that you've been snacking on lately?
So I've got, like, I've just been eating a lot of, like, mixed nuts.
You're a nuts guy?
Probably qualify as healthy. Yeah. Yeah, I like nuts. I also eat fruit. I have, like, strawberries, grapes, bananas, whatever.
I'm going to hit you with a deep cut. I'm on the fruit deep cups right now because I'm trying to eat better overall. So I need to vary my healthy foods that I eat. But I'm on a huge raspberry kick right now. I can just pick up a handful of raspberries, eat those bad boys like they're nothing. I love raspberries right now.
Okay. I'm not a big fan of raspberries, but I'm glad they work for you.
It's okay. What about you, Josh? What kind of healthy snacks have you been munching on down there in New Zealand?
Yeah, I'm a big fan of mixed nuts as well. Otherwise, just good old water always does the trick for just making sure keep the thirst at bay rather than sugary drinks. And yeah, occasionally salad or raw carrot or something like that. But yeah, it's a good choice, Michael. I approve.
Awesome.
And I don't want you to get twisted, though. I will still happily eat New Zealand chocolate if it was ever gifted to me in some kind of circumstance. I'm always happy to make an exception for that wonderful, wonderful New Zealand chocolate.
Be treat-wise, that's the key.
And then, did you ever get around to eating? I imagine you did. Those
Buckeyes?
Buckeyes, yeah.
Oh my God, they were so good. So I'm not usually a big fan of peanut butter and chocolate. Like Reese's Pieces and Reese's Peanut Butter Cups and whatever. Yeah, they're all right. Those Buckeyes, though. Oh, my God. They were so good. So I don't know. Like maybe when I meet you again, I might do a bit of a trade. A bit of Whitaker's for Buckeyes. Or,
sure. I'm happy to make that trade. It seems like a fair trade to me. Have you ever had Buckeyes, Michael?
Yeah, I really like Buckeyes. I'm with you, Josh. I'm like, I never really liked Reese's that much, and then I tried Buckeyes, and I'm like, these are so good.
Yeah, the creaminess of it is what gets, I think, the big difference. Oh,
absolutely, absolutely. And the story along with it, you know, can't give up a good story for it.
Well, sure, the Buckeye story? I don't know the story.
The Buckeye State?
Yeah.
From Ohio. And then, so there's also, I gave you specifically Mally's Buckeyes, and the story that came with it was, I think I've told you the story before, was that Mally's is like, I think the largest candy manufacturer in the state of Ohio. And I forget when it was, but sometime in the past few decades, they invented their own fake holiday called Sweetest Day. I think Sweetest Day is coming up, right? Or just happened recently, Sweetest Day. Because I think it's 6 months outside after February. No, this year Sweetest Day is on Saturday, October 19th. So right before we leave for Worlds is Sweetest Day. And it's just a made up holiday that Mally's made up so that people buy chocolate more often in the year. So you have to give your sweetest days. And it was a big deal when I was like in like elementary and like middle school. It's like, if you liked a girl, it's like, you had to get her that Mally's chocolate for Sweetest Day.
Sweetest Day. Yeah.
It wasn't legit.
Sounds like good advertising.
It worked. Yeah. I don't know. So it's ingrained in me that.
It's definitely one of those things where it's like, you know, you grow up thinking like, you know, your childhood is normal, and then you like meet someone and you're like, hey, like, what are you doing for Sweetest Day? And I'm like, what the fuck are you talking about?
I had no idea it wasn't a real holiday. I had that exact circumstance growing in like my 20s, and somebody was like, I have no idea what you're talking about. I was like, oh, interesting. And then I learned all about corporate propaganda, and then here we are.
Yep. Yeah, you grow up and realize that the world's a lot bigger than you thought.
Yeah. But thankfully, there's no corporate propaganda here. Thankfully, LSS is just the best actual company on the entire face of the planet that makes the best card game on the face of the planet with the best judges staff on the face of the planet. So no propaganda here, just straight facts.
Well, I thank you for your honesty there, Roger. And I appreciate you spreading the good word about Legend Story Studios and their judge program.
I do what I can. But I think to kick things off, though, I think, Michael, you have your own story that you kind of wanted to get into about kind of your most recent foray into some judges on the competitive scene, eh?
Yeah. So I remember, I think it was sometime last year, the trigger policy was changed. There was a whole like pummel situation and kind of led to triggers being reworked. And I never like really fully understood how they worked until, well, I wouldn't say I fully understand how they work, but I got a better idea at Nationals when I had a pretty interesting situation happen in my stream game. I was playing against New, I was playing Enigma, and basically my opponent attacks me with some stealth card that when they banish cards of a type, they gain a life. I block with the card. They say banish it. They go to after the combat chain resolves, they banish it. They go to 21 and they're like, I banish the card off the top of your deck. And I do. Then we go to my turn and I start playing my turn. And they're like, wait, shouldn't I be at 22? Because the card they banished from the top of the deck was the card. I don't remember which stealth card it was, but it was a card of the type. I'm like, let's call a judge because I don't know what to do here. I don't know if I'm supposed to send them to 22. So we call a judge. Judge is like, yeah, you go to 22. That's cool. And then there hadn't been anything that happened that made it. I don't know exactly why that was the case, but they went to 22. And I'll let Josh explain why this is how it works after I get through the whole story. So then the next turn, they attack me with a stealth card. I let it hit me. They're like, okay, your turn. And I look at my hand, I look at my turn, and the stealth card hit me, and they never told me to banish top card of my deck. And I'm like, do I have to banish top card of the deck? So I call a judge over. I'm like, hey, judge, this is a situation that happened. And the judge was basically told me that now that it had been drawn attention to, we could still resolve the trigger. So we were going to go ahead and do that. So I basically think that knowing what you're responsible for is really important, and knowing what you are not responsible for so you don't basically call attention to something and give your opponent a benefit from it is also really important. I was wondering if you could kind of like explain how all that works, Josh.
Yeah, of course. For a bit of background, I did write an article on this back alley Oracle like 11. I think it was published back in July last year, so it's been a little bit over a year now with this policy. The idea behind it is that the core idea behind it is that Flesh and Blood is designed the way that it's intended to be played. So when the developers create triggers, for example, they create effects and whatnot, and something happens in the game, they operate under the assumption, or they design or develop under the assumption, that these things will actually happen in the game. So when a trigger goes off, like a mandatory trigger, like start of turn or on hit or taking damage or something like that, the assumption is that that trigger will be resolved, and everything balanced within the game, it operates under the assumption that that is going to happen. So the idea is that when we create policy, what we want to do is we want to realize that within actual tournament play. And that is, when something happens or something should happen, we want to operate as close to that as possible so that the game is balanced as the game has been intended to be balanced by the developers. So you think of something like Ponder, for example. You've got a token in the arena, it's meant to trigger at the end of your turn. You draw a card before your arsenal. If you miss that trigger, it becomes very weird what can happen, because if you resolve it later, then, you know, after the turn is like, you know, the turn is done and you've arsenaled a card, technically you could get like a 5-card hand, or if you just leave it as is, you can delay and have a ponder for a different turn. And that just messes a bit with the game balance and the game design, and basically the intentions of where we wanted to be with the game. So the fundamental part of why we decided to change our trigger policy from old policy, which very closely resembled what Magic did with its triggers, was that we wanted to more closely realize what the game developers, or our game developers, had intended for these game states and this balance. And sort of realizing it closer to what we do with game rules violations, which are something should have happened. Let's try and get the game on track to what that should have happened. I guess you can sort of more think of it like, instead of just treating triggers like their own thing and having a separate path for how to solve it, we do actually just treat it a little bit closer to how we treat game rules violations, but we just have a slightly different penalty because we understand that triggers are easier to miss or easier to mess up. And there's a lot of cultural baggage around triggers as well. So like you're saying, even with, player responsibility, for example, I know a lot of players don't think that they should be responsible for their opponent's triggers. Like, what do you guys think? Do you think that you should be responsible for pointing out your opponent's triggers?
I honestly don't have a strong opinion on it either way. I just want to know what I am supposed to do. So I can play to maximize my chances of winning games without like going outside of the rules. Like I want to stay everything above the board. But if like, that's why going back to my example, I called the judge when my opponent didn't have me banished top card. I'm like, is this what I'm supposed to be doing?
Yeah. Like I think it's interesting because we've had so many years of so many competitive players coming from Magic the Gathering where there was a point in time in Magic where you were responsible for pointing out your opponent's triggers, and the community didn't like that at all. And it very quickly changed again back to where players weren't responsible for pointing out triggers anymore. I think there's a real there's two ends of the spectrum, right? You're either responsible for everything that your opponent does or you're not responsible at all. And right now for things like game rules violations, so that's your just typical something does, someone does something wrong in your game, you are partly responsible for that because, you should recognize that the game state needs to be maintained. You want to try and make sure that you're playing as clean as possible and the integrity of the game is sort of there. But with missed triggers, we sort of have a bit of this baggage, and we also recognize that triggers are more likely to be missed. So what we've done is we sort of met this middle ground where it's like, you aren't responsible for pointing out your opponent's missed triggers. You can, obviously, you can either just tell them that, oh, you've missed this trigger, go do that. Or you can do what you've done, obviously, Michael, which is call a judge. But the on the other side of things, what we want to try and do is we want to try and resolve that trigger rather than give an opponent the advantage of deciding whether or not to put that trigger on the stack and give them a strategic competitive advantage of basically, oh, I'm going to let him miss that trigger because I get an advantage by deciding whether or not it goes on the stack at a certain point in time. Instead, we remove that away from the player and say, well, if the trigger does get caught after the period it's been missed, then we'll do our best to reinstate that regardless of what the opponent wants to do. We want to try and maintain that integrity.
How does the different levels of rules enforcement come into play with this at all? Is there any difference between casual, competitive, or professional rules enforcement level as far as missed triggers are concerned?
So not for missed triggers. So our penalties and procedures for competitive and professional are pretty straightforward across the board for missed triggers. It's the same with game rules violations where, we try to partial fix, we try to rewind, and if we get to a point that we can't, then we just sort of let the game as is. The only difference for missed triggers is that there's not for competitive professional, but just in general compared to game rules violation, is that we don't penalize you if you would have gained an advantage by missing it. So if you would have been, if it was detrimental, oh, sorry, what's the word for it? it's always difficult to explain beneficial versus detrimental. The idea is that if you missed a trigger and you gained an advantage by missing it, then you get a warning because, hey, you might have intentionally missed that trigger, and it's better to give you a warning for that so that you try and not prevent them from gaining continuous advantages from missing those types of triggers. But if they're actually put into a worse position by missing that trigger, we just give you a caution. So you miss a trigger that gains you a life, we wouldn't penalize you for that. That would just be a caution because it was like, look, you've missed that. Don't worry about it. We're just going to try and fix it. Just try to do better in the long run. But if you miss a trigger that would lose you a life, it's like, hey, by missing this trigger, you're actually better off. So we're just warning you that, you know, you need to play fairly and you need to make sure that you're not trying to abuse missing triggers, putting yourself in a better position than your opponent by missing them. So here is a warning. We've recorded it and we can track these missed triggers throughout the tournament to make sure that you're not repeating this behavior. And if you do repeat this behavior, we can upgrade this penalty or perform an investigation to make sure that there's no other intentions afoot, essentially.
So with that then, so with the infamous pommel, right, where my opponent doesn't say destroy your arsenal or discard your card, if I don't discard my card and then it gets pointed out later, do I get that penalty then? Because I, even though my opponent controlled that trigger, that would have been detrimental to me. I don't want to discard this card. I want this card in my hand.
So there is a, the caveat of who controls the trigger is all about who actually created that trigger or who's actually in control of that trigger. So, for example, a pummel situation. I play pummel. The effect of the trigger is something that I own as the person who played that pummel, who controlled that pummel. Even though it affects the opponent, it's my responsibility to ensure that the opponent follows that particular resolution of that trigger. So if the opponent doesn't discard and I don't tell them, and then later on we discover that he should have discarded, most cases, and I say most cases because it is very circumstantial, there might be a situation where I don't want him to discard because, you know, maybe graveyard fill for Levia or something like Levia, sorry. In that particular situation, like there might be a situation where it was actually beneficial for me to get the damage in, but not the discard. And that's something that we want to take into context here because it's not very clear cut that every effect is divided into beneficial or detrimental. A lot of them lean towards one or the other, but it is entirely dependent on context. Like, you know, the creation of a token, is that beneficial or detrimental? Well, it depends on the context of the token. Like, even things like Briar versus Icelander matchup, there were cases where people were intentionally missing their embodiment of Earth trigger because that then gives them a window for the Icelander to play before the opponent gets to play an attack. And you'd say, oh, creating an embodiment of Earth, that's beneficial. Like, you know, you always want to do that, absolutely, every time, because it's value. But, you know, in some situations it's actually a detrimental trigger. Like, you know, you want to make sure that you are applying the correct penalty based on the context. In terms of casual play, it's a little bit different because we have an entirely different procedure guide for casual play where we try to resolve them similar to game rules violations, but we don't give out warnings, we don't give out IP2s. It's more about the education side of things at this sort of like armory and skirmish level.
That makes a lot of sense. And so before I get into what I wanted to talk about next then, do you feel satisfied with that answer, Michael, or do you still have some gray areas as far as like the specific nuances of triggers?
I guess the last question I have about it is when deciding whether to apply like a partial fix or what if it's gone too far, is there like some like general guidelines that judges have for determining what point that is?
Yep. So we have a in the penalty procedure guideline, we talk about partial fixes and when they should be applied. There's a lot of nuance in that particular aspect as well, because we have so many different parts of the game that can interact with these sorts of partial fixes. So a big one, for example, is like ponder. If you have a missed ponder trigger, for example, and you draw up to your hand size before you realize that you've missed that ponder trigger, it basically means that, okay, well, we can't resolve the draw card from the ponder now in terms of the partial fix because you've already drawn up to your hand size. You've already drawn those extra cards before you would have drawn the ponder, and you might have shuffled those cards. You don't know which one you would have drawn first. You gained information about what sort of cards are coming up, etc. So you've already missed that part of resolving that partial fix for the ponder. you haven't missed the part where you would have destroyed the ponder token at that point in time. So if you miss a ponder trigger and you draw up your cards and you're like, oh, I had a ponder trigger, judge, come have a look. The judge would be like, yep, look, sorry, you've missed your opportunity to draw from the ponder and arsenal and then drop to your hand size. We're just going to destroy this ponder trigger and move on. So there are like guidelines around some of those nuances, especially when you're drawing up to your hand size. But there's also guidelines on, you know, if you've missed a trigger or you've performed a game rules violation and your opponent has, you know, given you some information, they've played some cards, maybe you've had some back and forth, it might be too late to resolve a partial fix because you've started to play the game based on the current game state, your current understanding of the game state. And that's when we would consider, okay, can we roll it back? Can we, you know, would you change anything about your actions if we roll this back, and what sort of information has been revealed? And then at, you know, a certain point, there might be a case where, you know, a partial fix isn't acceptable, a rollback isn't acceptable. We actually just have to continue the game as is and we'll apply the appropriate penalties. And for mistrigger, that is often either a caution or warning, or for game rules violation, it will be, you know, maybe even an IP2 if you've gained a significant advantage by, you know, doing something bad. It's one of those things where it's like, you know, we don't want players to have to worry about like trying to resolve everything perfectly. We want players to focus on the game, focus on playing correctly, focus on playing their best, and then if something goes wrong, call a judge. Judges are there to help you and help, you know, maintain the game state, maintain this integrity, and help you get through this thing. They know the rules, they know the policy, they can look it up and they can help you through it. Just call a judge.
Absolutely. So I'm actually going to pivot here. This wasn't even on the list, but you said a phrase that triggered PTSD in me, and that was gained information. And the lawyering in me wants to let's talk about gaining information and like what does that mean? Because technically, as time passes, that's information gained. Like, so it's one of those things where it's almost so encompassing that it's meaningless. And here's my example, right? Where so I was playing in Nationals. And I was controlling a manifestation of Mirror Guy in a draft. And so I was in a good spot, right? And so my opponent attacks me, and they're attacking me for 8. And I look at my manifestation of Mirror Guy, and it's got 4+1+1 counters on it. And I think in my head, well, it deals damage equal to the double of +1/+1. So attacks for 8, it should have 8 ward too. I don't need a block, so my other auras over here are safe. We go to damage, and my opponent's like, okay, blow up all your auras. And I'm like, what? My manifestation of Mirror Guy destroys everything, or absorbs. He's like, no, it only has ward 4. And I call a judge, and I'm like, judge, I would have blocked had I known that my Mirror Guy only had 4 ward. But since I thought I had 8, can I block? And the judge says, no, learning how your card works is gaining information. And I say, okay. So that just always, at the time, that really rubbed me the wrong way. Because I was like that is gaining information, but that's just not like how I would think like the information that would affect the game state, I guess, you know, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, that's a real tough one. What event was this again?
It was National, so we were pro RE. Oh, so okay. I should know how my cards work at the day 2 of drafting Nationals.
This is day 2 also.
Yeah, so I just had never played with the card before. I played against it a bunch, and my opponents just deal with all the ward stuff. I just tried to get it gone. So
yeah, the opponent plays manifestations of Mirror Guy, and you just concede it there. Like, if you actually resolve the ward on it before,
either it dies immediately to like 1 point over, and the amount of ward it has doesn't matter anyways, or it scoops. So I never have to deal with that nuance. But funnily enough, I won that game anyways. So,
oh well, that's great. It's a good outcome at least. But yeah, no, I can understand that frustration. I think there's a there's an important aspect to dive into there, which is element of education as well. Like, you know, we're all human and we all make mistakes and we don't have perfect information about every single card or every single interaction. Even myself, like, you know, I'll occasionally like mess up an interaction or there'd be something that's ambiguous that I haven't resolved yet within the rules. And sometimes that catches me off guard. So like these sorts of things do happen from time to time. I think the important thing is that there is a distinction to be made depending on the REL and the tournament where we have a different focus on the game. And that is the aspect of education versus the integrity of the game itself, where, you know, at lower RELs like casual or even competitive, you know, the judge will be looking at like making sure that you're being educated about the game, that you're learning these rules, you're learning these cards, you have an opportunity to be able to make mistakes, rewind them, as long as they don't affect the game and those sorts of things, where, you know, they'll be more lenient in terms of rollbacks and making sure that you understand what's going on about the game. But when we get up to that professional REL, the understanding is that the players do have an understanding about the card. That is the general assumption, is that they understand the cards that they're playing with. And if they don't understand an interaction with a card, that they'll try and call a judge beforehand. But when we get up to a situation where a player, you know, like yourself, makes a mistake about a certain understanding about that card, we often take the role of integrity over education, because if we allow players to be able to roll back or make different decisions based on either new information or you know, learning certain interactions, we open up this world where players can start to abuse that in really high level gameplay, where, you know, players will say, oh, I didn't know how that's worked. Can we go back to blocks? Or can we go back to declaring this? Or I didn't mean to declare that mode because I didn't think that's how it works. And they can gain information. They can gain understanding about, you know, an opponent's, like, you know, what they would do past certain steps. Like, oh, you know, he didn't play an attack reaction. Okay, I wonder if I can go back to blocks and then block out, or, you know, certain things like that. So it is unfortunate that, you know, we do, like, it's just the reality of it, that we do have situations where, you know, we don't understand these cards, we don't understand interactions 100% of the time. But what we try to do is we try to do our best in the education at this casual and competitive, and, you know, give you the opportunity to learn these cards and learn these interactions and be the best player that you can be, so that when you come to these professional level tournaments, that you can apply that knowledge and apply those interactions, and you can just focus on the strategy without being caught out by these small nuances or these small issues. So I encourage everyone to go to their armories, to go to their skirmishes, to go to their ProQuests and Road to Nationals and play lots of games, because it does
gain your information
help you
beforehand.
Absolutely.
Okay. So also baked into that, though, was tournament integrity there. I think that's also kind of, you were talking about in the trigger policy as well. And I think right now I have concerns about the bystander policy as far as that is concerned, where, to me, my current understanding is that there is no way for any party outside of a game to catch something or see something going wrong and try to fix it in the game. So back in Magic the Gathering, for example, I actually watched a lot of games, just people playing, things like that. It wasn't even just my friends, but I would see missed triggers or something like that, or somebody misresolving a card, and I would say, hey, could you guys stop for a second? I'm going to call a judge. And they would stop, a judge would come over, they would explain their situation, and the judge would go, oh, I see what happened here. You didn't pay your life for your fetch land or whatever. And it frequently happened just throughout the game, because games are hard. But in Flesh and Blood, you obviously can't do that. You can't say, hey, please stop your game, I'm going to call a judge. I believe the current is supposed to be secretly walk away from the table, let a judge know, and then they'll go over and investigate afterwards. But also feel I don't even know if that is that, I guess, first and foremost, is that what you're supposed to do across the board at all rules enforcement levels?
Yep. So obviously there's some leniency in the casual scene, like where, you know, players are trying to learn the game. We might, you know, again, focus on education as opposed to the integrity of the game, because players are starting out, they're learning cards, and we want players to be educated and learn these sort of mistakes as early as possible. So there is leniency at the casual level. But when we come to competitive and professional, and I think this is really important to understand the difference between games like Magic the Gathering and games like Flesh and Blood, where in a game of Flesh and Blood, you're presented with a lot of new information every single turn. You're drawing up a full new hand every single turn. You're responding to every interaction that your opponent is playing, because they play an attack. You've got to make decisions. You focused on those particular interactions. You're planning your next turn in advance. And there's so much like bandwidth of information coming through you at every single moment of the game. And, you know, at the highest levels, you're quite, you know, intensely focused on the game itself rather than what's going on around you. And one of the key aspects of creating a good game environment, and James and I have had a, you know, a good couple of conversations about this, is that we don't want to simply stop and interrupt that interaction between you and your opponent. We don't want to stop games unnecessarily. This has been applied to like judge policy, for example. So like we've been exploring the ideas of deck checks and whether or not we could do like simple deck checks mid round, where we like stop a game, we just count how many cards are in your deck, like i.e. how many cards you're holding, how many in your deck, how many in the graveyard, how many you've got in the thing, and then just like let it go. And this something that we're exploring for things like Limited, where we're just, you know, seeing if people have 30 cards, for example. But the issue, of course, that came up was we don't want to just interrupt somebody's thought process, because interrupting somebody during the game creates a really poor play experience, because you're so intently focused on what your opponent is doing, your own thought process, your own train of thought, what you're going to be doing next turn. And that sort of, again, carries on to the spectator policy, because we have tried it previously. This is before I came into the company, where players were able to interrupt certain games or interrupt games to like point out errors. And we had lots of cases where players would point out things that weren't errors, that weren't issues with the rules. And in other card games, that might not be as consequential because it isn't as much, you know, throughput, I can't remember the term for it, of information, so much information that's coming through your head at any given point. And it's easier to sort of pick up where you left off. But with Flesh and Blood, we found that it was really impacting the pace of play, as well as impacting the player's experience and enjoyment of the game itself. So we've taken the road where we want to be more cautious on that particular aspect and leave it up to the players and up to the judges rather than letting spectators intervene in particular games. And I think there are situations where, you know, obviously there are downsides to that. Like obviously, you know, things get missed, a spectator sees it, they call a judge, the judge sees that it's been missed, it's too late, they can't fix it, maybe they apply a penalty, or judge doesn't see what's wrong and the game just continues with that particular error. That is definitely a downside. And it can even happen with stream games where there is a bit of a delay on, you know, a spectator in the chat pointing out an error that goes through to the broadcasting team. The broadcasting team lets the judge know, the judge investigates, and like it's already too late to fix that particular error. Like that's absolutely a downside to this particular aspect of the game. But I think that at this point in time, we are more comfortable with this because we have seen an increase in enjoyment of the game when spectators don't interfere to try and point out these errors. And in terms of like another aspect to it is missed triggers, for example, where you're not responsible for pointing out missed triggers of your opponent. But if a spectator who doesn't understand the rules, you know, points out a missed trigger of, you know, the opponent because they missed it and, you know, the player's sitting there, that's kind of like really close to outside assistance, because basically you're performing the action of a player, and you're pointing out something that the players themselves should have noticed. And that creates a bit of imbalance as well. Like you might have, you know, two players, A and B, and all of the spectators are on player A's side. So they'll make sure that they only point out the missed triggers for players A, but not for player B. And that can create a dichotomy of a poor player or a poor game experience as well. So the idea is that we want to make sure that the game currently is focused on the two players, where spectators are spectators. They're not involved in the game. They're not giving information. They're not interfering with the game. And that if there does need to be some outside interference into the game, something that stops the game, that we're doing it through the proper procedures of going through an official, a tournament official, who can make the call as to whether the game needs to be stopped at that point for an investigation or for a penalty or procedure to be given out. That's essentially where we're at the moment.
That makes sense. And for triggers, I definitely can understand where you're coming from on that policy. But for things like, I guess what really rubs me the wrong way about this policy is I could be watching Michael's match and Michael's opponent could be playing with five intellect every turn. And Michael's just not noticing it because he's so wrapped up with playing with his own cards, or just he or his opponent blocks with a piece of armor and then just puts it right back when he's done with it so he can block with it again later. And like there's opportunistic cheating available that's happened that does happen either in, I guess, either intentionally or not intentionally, if we set aside that whole aspect of that as well. Or I guess, once again, just like, you attack me for four with a wounded blow. I say, okay, no blocks. I don't write my life total down. You don't write my life total down. We just move on from the game. That we just, that's like that attack never happened. And it feels bad to me as the spectator if I'm watching my friend play in a game and then two turns later he loses the game because by four life or something like that. I couldn't do anything about it. Or it feels like I couldn't do anything about it.
I can definitely understand that. And that's why we encourage players to, or spectators to alert judges discreetly. Because if there is something afoot, if there is somebody taking advantage of another player, like you said, drawing five intellect every turn, blocking and then not destroying their equipment, or attacking and not changing the life totals, those are absolutely things that judges can fix in post. And do an investigation on, and even end up in a situation where they can, you know, perform an investigation and maybe even investigate allegations of opportunistic cheating or even cheating. So we absolutely do encourage players that if they think something is really, if they're, you know, they're confident that something is wrong with the game, go and get a judge, because judges are there to help you. And we want players to rely on our judge program, because we've put so much effort into training our judges and making sure that they're the best can possibly be to be there for your customer service needs, for your rules and policy queries, and to investigate these issues, so that players don't feel burdened that they have to be responsible for all the other players around them. If you're playing a game, that should be your only focus. If you're watching a game, you should be there enjoying the game as a spectator. And if you don't feel comfortable about what a player is doing, call a judge, because we put those judges at events. We train them up for those situations, and we want games to be as, you know, high integrity as possible. But we have to do that through our policy and the way, and make sure that that is consistent throughout our tournaments. And if you want to make sure that a judge is involved, call a judge. That's essentially the policy and the process that we want to go through with our tournaments.
So I actually have a follow-up question on that. So calling a judge as a spectator, you can't pause the game, but you can call a judge. If you're like sitting right by the match and you shout judge and raise your hand, a lot of the time the players in the game know that it's like related to their game.
So that's why you're supposed to discreetly.
Discreetly.
Yep. Discreet. Okay, great.
Yeah. The idea would basically be that you don't go ahead and just go judge. Like, you know, yeah. We're not trying to like go ahead and like, you know, how you say, consequently pause the game from your actions without asking the players to pause the game. It would be you're sitting by a table, you notice something is going amiss, you go, okay, I'm just going to leave, go get a judge, bring them here, and while you're bringing the judge there, tell them what's going on so that you don't have to stand in front of the game saying what is wrong. Yeah. Judges like to know what's going on while they're walking to tables.
Yeah.
And then the judge can make a call as to whether or not to intervene. And, you know, quite often, like, if you start off with, you know, something like, look, this player just drew 5 cards in his hand. He didn't have any plus intellect. You know, something needs to happen. Like, if you just start off with the issue, the judge can immediately come in and just be like, hey, guys, can we just pause the game for a second? Can I just check how many cards did you start the turn with, et cetera, et cetera? And they can just launch immediately into the thing. You don't have to start off with, so I was watching this game between this guy and this guy, and this guy's playing Bravo, and this guy's playing Enigma. Okay, and this turn, he started off, and he didn't have any intellect, and then like, the judge would be like, right, just get to the problem. Like, what am I trying to solve here? Like, we're already at the table. Like, what is going on? If you start off with the problem, and the judge can ask you any, you know, additional follow-ups as you're getting to the table, they can immediately intervene in the problem. And it really cuts down on that time as well. But again, we want to do this as policy, which is do it discreetly so we're not interrupting games because, you know, your call could be wrong and we don't want to create that poor player experience of just interrupting games when we don't understand them or that we might not understand them as well as the players do who are actually playing the game.
Okay. So you brought this up too, though, in one of your examples with the chat thing, and that's a whole can of worms separately as well. And I'm not going to get into specifics, don't worry. But is there an official stance from LSS as far as stream goes and stream game outside interference goes? Is that considered its own can of worms now, basically?
So it's a big can of worms because of stream delay for starters. Like, you know, you saw with our latest Pro Tour, we might have even started on like a 2-hour delay or something like that. It was enormous. And it was fantastic because, you know, there was a lot less downtime, players enjoyed the stream a bit more. But of course, that means that any interaction from that particular stream, we can't go back and, you know, interfere in a game or change something like that. However, if there is a game with a much shorter delay or no delay, there have been cases where we've run tournaments where we have somebody watching the stream. And they'll watch the game through the stream. They'll check up on stream chat as well. And they basically perform the role of a sit-in spectator, which is somebody notices something, that person that's watching the stream and watching the stream chat, they'll alert the judge that something is amiss. And then again, the judge will come in and you know, try and fix the situation. And it's the same with broadcast as well. The way that we want things to run is that if you're on the broadcast team, that if you're not acting in that judge role, that you just have a close communication with judges so that if something is wrong that you notice, that you alert the judge and the judge makes that decision. That's essentially the dynamic that we're trying to create with these larger events where we have the separation between broadcast and you know judge staff. We want to put the power into the judge's hands to be able to make the decision of whether or not to intervene or to perform an investigation. And it's just a matter of refining those particular, that process or that pipeline, that information pipeline, so that we get the information to the judges as soon as possible to be able to make those decisions and interact with those games when they need to be interacted with.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. Thanks for clarifying that. So I actually feel a lot better now. And did you have any questions before we move on, Michael? Cool. So this one's going to be, I don't know, potentially quick, potentially long. What's the difference between gets and gains on these recent templating changes on cards?
Oh, I love this stuff. I love this stuff because hardly anybody talks about it.
I recently sat in on recent debates on a Supreme Court argument about the definition of the word and. So please get on. I'm here for it.
So back in the days, back in the WTR days, moving on, there was a very vague distinction between two types of effects, gains and has. And gains was essentially a resolution ability, so that is something that resolves on the stack and gives something temporary to a to an object. So your next attack gains plus two, or right. target attack on the stack gains plus three, or something like that. Has was used in a static context, which is there's something in the arena that gives an additional something to either like a bunch of objects yeah. or yeah, like Channel Mount Heroic. Trying to think, there's a couple of WTR cards as well where like Guardian
modify defense though, right?
Stonewall Confidence.
Yeah, that one modifies defense. Where
I think Stonewall Confidence was. I'm going to look it up right now just to make sure. Stonewall Confidence has gains and Anothos. No, it's gains. I think we did. Maybe we started with gains and then we introduced has. I think that might have been the case. But the idea was that we had gains and then we had has, and has was sort of more used in a static context, but it wasn't one to one. It wasn't static abilities, wasn't resolution abilities. They sort of like mixed and mingled a little bit. And then we came up with Arcane Rising. Arcane Rising had Ravenous Rabble, and we had to use a minus for that, a minus power. And minus power used gets because you can't gain negative one, and using has negative one was not appropriate because it was a resolution ability. So we ended up in the situation where we had three different types of words that meant exactly the same thing, which was there's a continuous effect that modifies the power or defense or some other property of a card. And then when I came in as rules and policy manager, I started to do a bit more proofing. And one of the things that I was tasked with was basically making formalizing our syntax a little bit more clearly. And I started with trying to make a clear distinction between gains and has for resolution and static abilities. But we very quickly found that it was unsustainable because there are a lot of cases where we would change abilities last minute and it would get lost in the proofing phase because there'd be it's very hard to immediately distinguish whether or not you should be using gains or has or gets. And the other part of it is we have a lot of abilities that referenced gaining power or losing power. So if like, like Caution, for example, abilities that like can't gain power, like Snag or what's the Guardian attack action card where things can't gain power? It's not Crush the Weak, it's something else. Choke Slam. Yeah. That's the one. So the idea was that we wanted to consolidate our syntax to try and create something that's a little bit more understandable. So we decided that we would use the more universal gets, which means that we can do increases to power, decreases to power, and we can also use the same keyword or the same sort of phrase for gaining ability text as well. So what we did is we moved from gains, has, gets to just gets. And then we also started to cut down on the syntax for getting the super types as well. So I believe really early on we had a card, I think it might have been Phantasmify. Next attack action card you play this turn is Illusionist in addition to its other class types. And it's like, okay, well, that's, long and unnecessary. So we just shorten that down to is Illusionist. And that is basically the same as gets, which is it gains this as a super type, either a class or a talent. And we don't have to say in addition to its other class types.
So does that mean there was basically a non-functional errata to anything that says gain then basically is gets?
Yeah, I mean, when we say non-functional errata, there were a lot of non-functional errata. Like, a ton, a huge amount. And when I say non-functional errata, we basically mean we're moving to a more standardized, modern syntax. So you'll see this with things like we're replacing card names and text with just this. And that is being translated across a lot of languages now as well. And what that does is that not only cuts down on card text for the text box, which means that we can, you know, create less of a burden on players reading cards or presenting them with like huge paragraphs of information where we have to say the name of the card over and over and over again. But it is also more clear when we're referring to the current object that this card is on versus another object with the same name, like, you know, say 100 wins or, you know, other cards that reference the same name as themselves, but referring to a different object. So I think Flood of Force is probably another example where we would like, I think it's Flood of Force. Yeah, Flood of Force would mentions its own name in its text box, but we're talking about an object that was the last attack, not itself. So there are cases where we want to make sure that we're in a situation where we're removing as much text from these text boxes as possible, while still being as clear and concise as possible to the people who are reading these text boxes to understand what a card is actually doing. And I think we're slowly getting to a more consolidated syntax. There are obviously, you know, more ongoing changes that we're, you know, just tightening up certain aspects of how we describe effects, how we describe abilities or triggers or replacement effects, especially as we start to increase or delve into more complex interactions. But I think that we've come to a point now where we've established very clearly what the style of fab cards are. And that includes things like removing gains and has and putting in gets and removing card names and putting in this and a few other tweaks here and there as well.
Sure. Anybody who's watching saw me go through a whirlwind of emotions like, well, what about this interaction? I pull up a card and I'm like, okay, well, this kind of falls under it. The big one that I was thinking of was, are four powered or three or four power cards still poppers when you have Chianomout Heroic out? Like, I was wondering if this somehow nerfed Chianomout Heroic. And I walk through this in my head like this. So this says attack action cards you control either have plus three, but now you can say get plus three power. So given that it still just says attack action cards, it doesn't have to be an attack. I believe they would still be considered poppers on defense. Do
yep,
I understand?
That's correct.
I'm a judge.
No, yeah, that's, like I said, there's no functional changes here. It's all just modern syntax and just, you know, cleaner ways of describing exactly the same thing. Channel Mount Heroic is an aura. This ability is phrased like a static ability. Attack action cards you control get three. It's an authoritative statement. So, you know, and it's on an aura, which is a permanent, which means it's a static ability. Attack action cards you control. So it's not an attack. It's just attack action cards you control. You control defending attack action cards on the combat chain. Therefore, they get plus three. So there's no functional changes. It works exactly how you know how it did before. All we're doing is just improving the syntax for players.
Okay. It's cool. Sounds good. I'm glad that we clarified that, because I was just thinking like, oh, is this going to be like a functional change? Is this not a functional change? Does this matter at all? It's good to know that's just something. So thank you for clarifying.
I mean, we could talk for hours about syntax. I don't think your listeners
would really love it. If you ever want to just like DM me sometime and be like, Roger, can you explain to me like what you think about the syntax of gets versus gains? I would love to go down those rabbit holes with you anytime.
I mean, honestly, like the latest one that we were looking at was title capitalization rules, because like we've got so many phrases now that aren't just names of places or things. Like, you know, we've got entire phrases in there, and it's like, okay, well, how do we capitalize or, you know, title case for each of these, you know, these phrases? And how do we deal with hyphenations or, you know, prepositions of like four characters or more? And we're sort of landed on, you know, a modified Chicago-based titleization style, and I'm pretty happy with it. But there are cases where, like, we would have to go back and change it. Like I said, we could talk about this forever.
I won't make our listeners suffer through any more of this. This is I'm here for this, but you know what? This is probably going to be its own separate, very different. Specific podcast, I guess.
Welcome to the Roger Bodhi podcast, where we just talk about
semantics. Welcome to the syntax podcast.
I'm here for it, man. I'm here for it.
We should start a syntax podcast.
I love it. I love it.
Okay. Well, we're coming up at about an hour, though. So aside from any syntax related things you want to get into, then is there anything you want to get into, anything you want to discuss or advocate for? Always happy to give a platform to you and the judging community.
Well, you know, the judge program is continuing to improve. We're continuing to grow as a community. We're continuing to mature as well as a program. Like, you know, we've seen improvements in the comprehensive rules, the penalty procedure guidelines, tournament rules and policy. We're starting to form a lot more of our own identity as well in terms of like how we do things and how we run things and the style and the community that we're forming. In terms of the judge community as well, we're sort of building out a lot more of our logistics. You know, obviously, judge packs are going through a couple of changes at the moment, and we're looking to try and improve that process to make it as enjoyable for judges to be able to get rewarded for their efforts. We're also creating some judge swag as well. So you can see I'm wearing a prototype Judges of Wraith jacket as well, and I'm currently drinking from the prototype Judges of Wraith drink bottle there. So that's a Camelback drink bottle that we gave out at the last Pro Tour for our judges. And, you know, we're starting to create a couple more things that, you know, we want to show our appreciation to our judge community because they do put in so much effort to helping us run this amazing game. And honestly, we just simply couldn't do it without them. I know a lot of our judges are players as well, and a lot of our judges would love to just play in these tournaments, but they've given up their valuable time to, you know, learn how to run these games, learn the logistics, learn the tournament operations side of things, and, you know, help put on these great shows. So I really appreciate the judge community, and we just want to continue to try and give back and make sure it's as good as we possibly can. And if you are interested, you viewer are interested in becoming a judge, you can head to judge.fabtcg.com and sign up, create an account, set your level one, set your level zero, set your level one, and then find a mentor and start working towards your level two. And you too, viewer, can become a fantastic judge for this great game.
What's your level? What is your, are you like level 80?
I think we established that I was level infinity or something at some point, but
it's a pretty high level. Really, got a lot of tests to take for that one.
I don't keep track of levels. It's you know, when you're creating tests and whatnot, it sort of becomes a bit redundant to take the tests that you create. So
that's fair. Okay. Yeah. Well, thank you very much for your time, Josh. We really appreciate it. Do you have anything else before we sign off, Michael?
I also want to thank you for coming on and answering our questions, and hopefully the viewers learned some great things too about how the game works and level or rules enforcement and stuff. Thank you.
Thank you very much for having me on. I really appreciate it. And I'm looking forward to next time that we get to have a long chat.
Yeah. Hopefully in Osaka we'll catch up, right?
Absolutely. Let's do it.
Sounds good. Well, the next time you're getting syntax now in Osaka, always remember, mind your manners. Thanks for watching.
It's getting, right? Getting.
Yeah, I said getting.
Oh, okay. And then on.